This is for Janet and Yeats. Christmas, 1965. A Child's Christmas in Wales by Dylan Thomas. One Christmas was so much like another in those years around the seatown corner, now and out of all sound except the distant speaking of the voices I sometimes hear a moment before sleep, that I can never remember whether it snowed for 6 days and 6 nights when I was 12, or whether it snowed for 12 days and 12 nights when I was 6. All the Christmases rolled down the two-toned sea like a cold and headlong moon, but the ice-edged, fish-freezing waves, and I plunge my hands in the snow and bring out whatever I can find. In goes my hand into that wool-white, bell-tongued ball of holidays resting at the rim of the carol-singing sea, and out come Mrs. Prothero and the firemen. It was on the afternoon of the day of Christmas Eve, and I was in Mrs. Prothero's garden, waiting for cats with her son Jim. It was snowing. It was always snowing at Christmas. December, in my memory, is white as Lapland, though there were no reindeers. But there were cats. Patient, cold and callous, our hands wrapped in socks, we waited to snowball the cats. Sleek and long as jaguars, and horrible whiskered, spitting and snarling, they would slink and sidle over the white back garden walls. And the lynx-eyed hunters, Jim and I, fur-capped and moccasined trappers from Hudson Bay, off Mumbles Road, would hurl our deadly snowballs at the green of their eyes. The wise cats never appeared. We were so still, Eskimo-footed Arctic marksmen in the muffling silence of the eternal snows, eternal ever since Wednesday, that we never heard Mrs. Prothero's first cry from her igloo at the bottom of the garden, or, if we heard it at all, it was to us like the far-off challenge of our enemy and prey, the neighbor's polar cat. But soon the voice grew louder. "Fire!" cried Mrs. Prothero, and she beat the dinner gong. And we ran down the garden with the snowballs in our arms toward the house, and smoke indeed was pouring out of the dining room, and the gong was bombolating, and Mrs. Prothero was announcing ruin like a town crier in Pompeii. This was better than all the cats in Wales standing on the wall in a row. We bounded into the house, laden with snowballs, and stopped at the front door of the smoke-filled room. Something was burning, all right. Perhaps it was Mr. Prothero, who always slept there after midday dinner with a newspaper over his face. But he was standing in the middle of the room saying, "A fine Christmas," and smacking at the smoke with a slipper. "Call the fire brigade," cried Mrs. Prothero as she beat the gong. "They won't be there," said Mr. Prothero. "It's Christmas." There was no fire to be seen. Only clouds of smoke, and Mr. Prothero, standing in the middle of them, waving his slipper as though he were conducting. "Do something," he said. And we threw all our snowballs into the smoke, I think we missed Mr. Prothero, and ran out of the house to the telephone box. "Let's call the police as well," Jim said, "and the ambulance, and Ernie Jenkins, he likes fires." But we only called the fire brigade. And soon the fire engine came, and three tall men in helmets brought a hose into the house, and Mr. Prothero got out just in time before they turned it on. Nobody could have had a noisier Christmas Eve. Nobody, and jogged from foot to foot like small boys wanting to go out. And then the presents, and then the presents after the Christmas box. And the cold postman, with a rose on his button nose, tinkled down the tea-tray-slithered run of the chilly, glinting hill. He went in his ice-bound boots like a man on fishmonger slabs. He wiggled his bag like a frozen camel's hump, dizzily turned the corner on one foot, and by God, he was gone. Get back to the presents. There were the useful presents. Engulfing mufflers of the old coach days, and mittens made for giant sloths, zebra scarfs of a substance like silky gum that could be tug-o-war down to the galoshes, blinding tam-o-shanters like patchwork tea cozies, and bunny-suited busbies, and balaclavas for victims of head-shrinking tribes. From aunts, who always wore wool next to the skin, there were mustached and rasping vests that made you wonder why the aunts had any skin left at all. And once I had a little crocheted nose bag from an aunt, now, alas, no longer whinnying with us. And pictureless books in which small boys, though warned with quotations not to, would skate on Farmer Giles' pond and did and drowned, and books that told me everything about the wasp except why. Go on to the useless presents. Bags of moist and many-colored jelly babies, and a folded flag, and a false nose, and a tram conductor's cap, and a machine that punched tickets and rang a bell. Never a catapult. Once, by mistake that no one could explain, a little hatchet, and a celluloid duck that made, when you pressed it, a most unduck-like sound, a mewing moo that an ambitious cat might make who wished to be a cow, and a painting book in which I could make the grass, the trees, the sea, and the animals any color I pleased. And still the dazzling sky-blue sheep are grazing in the red field under the rainbow-billed and pea-green birds. Hard-boiled, toffee, fudge in all sorts, crunches, cracknels, humbugs, glaciers, marzipan, and butter Welsh for the Welsh, and troops of bright tin soldiers who, if they could not fight, could always run, and snakes and families, and happy ladders, and easy hobby games for little engineers, complete with instructions. Oh, easy for Leonardo. And a whistle to make the dogs bark, to wake up the old man next door, to make him beat on the wall with his stick and shake our picture off the wall. And a packet of cigarettes. You put one in your mouth, and you stood at the corner of the street, and you waited for hours in vain for an old lady to scold you for smoking a cigarette, and then, with a smirk, you ate it. And then it was breakfast under the balloons. Were there uncles, like in our house? There are always uncles at Christmas, the same uncles. And on Christmas mornings, with dog-disturbing whistle and sugar fags, I would scour the swatched town for the news of the little world, and find always a dead bird by the white post office or by the deserted swings, perhaps a robin, all but one of his fires out. Men and women wading or scooping back from chapel with taproom noses and wind-bust cheeks, all albinos, huddle their stiff, black, jarring feathers against the irreligious snow. Mistletoe hung from the gas brackets in all the front parlors. There was sherry and walnut and bottled beer and crackers by the dessert spoons. And cats in their furabouts watched the fires, and the high-heaped fire spat, all ready for the chestnuts and the mulling pokers. Some few large men sat in the front parlors without their collars, uncles almost certainly, trying their new cigars, holding them out judiciously at arm's length, returning them to their mouths, coughing, and then holding them out again as though waiting for the explosion. And some few small aunts, not wanted in the kitchen, nor anywhere else for that matter, sat on the very edges of their chairs, poised and brittle, afraid to break, like faded cups and saucers. Not many those mornings trod the piling streets, an old man always, fawn-bowlered, yellow-gloved, and at this time of year, with spats of snow, would take his constitutional to the white bowling green and back, as he would take it wet or fine on Christmas Day or Doomsday. Sometimes two hale young men, with big pipes blazing, no overcoats, and wind-blown scarfs, would trudge, unspeaking, down to the forlorn sea, to work up an appetite, to blow away the fumes, who knows, to walk into the waves until nothing of them was left but the two curling smoke clouds of their inextinguishable briars. Then I would be slapdashing home, the gravy smell of the dinners of others, the bird smell, the brandy, the pudding and mints, coiling up to my nostrils. When out of a snow-clogged side lane would come a boy the spit of myself, with a pink-tipped cigarette and the violet past of a black eye, cocky as a bullfinch, leering all to himself. I hated him on sight and sound, and would be about to put my dog whistle to my lips and blow him off the face of Christmas, when suddenly he, with a violet wink, put his whistle to his lips and blew so stridently, so high, so exquisitely loud, that gobbling faces, their cheeks bulged with goose, would press against their tinseled windows the whole length of the white echoing street. For dinner, we had turkey and blazing pudding, and after dinner, the uncles sat in front of the fire, loosened all buttons, put their large, moist hands over their watch chains, groaned a little, and slept. Mothers, aunts, and sisters scuttled to and fro, bearing tureens. Auntie Bessie, who had already been frightened twice by a clockwork mouse, whimpered at the sideboard and had some elderberry wine. The dog was sick. Auntie Dosey had to have 3 aspirins, but Auntie Hannah, who liked port, stood in the middle of the snowbound backyard singing like a big-bosomed thrush. I would blow up balloons to see how big they would blow up to, and when they burst, which they all did, the uncles jumped and rumbled. In the rich and heavy afternoon, the uncles breathing like dolphins and the snow descending, I would sit among festoons and Chinese lanterns and nibble dates and try to make a model man-o-war, following the instructions for little engineers, and produce what might be mistaken for a sea-going tram car. Or I would go out, my bright new boots squeaking, into the white world, onto the seaward hill, to call on Jim and Dan and Jack, and to pad through the still streets, leaving huge, deep footprints on the hidden pavements. I bet people will think there's been hippos. What would you do if you saw a hippo coming down our street? I'd go like this, bang. I'd throw him over the railings and roll him down the hill, and then I'd tickle him under the ear, and he'd wag his tail. What would you do if you saw 2 hippos? Iron-flanked and bellowing he-hippos clanked and battered through the scudding snow toward us as we passed Mr. Daniel's house. Let's post Mr. Daniel a snowball through his letterbox. Let's write things in the snow. Let's write, Mr. Daniel looks like a spaniel all over his lawn. Or, we walked on the white shore. Can the fishes see it snowing? The silent, one-clouded heavens drifted on to the sea. Now we were snow-blind travelers lost on the North Hill, and vast, dew-lapped dogs with flasks round their necks ambled and shambled up to us, baying excelsior. We returned home through the poor streets, where only a few children fumbled with bare red fingers in the wheel-rutted snow and catcalled after us, their voices fading away as we trudged uphill into the cries of the dock birds and the hooting of ships out in the whirling bay. And then, at tea, the recovered uncles would be jolly, and the ice cake loomed in the center of the table like a marble grave. Auntie Hannah laced her tea with rum, because it was only once a year. Bring out the tall tales now that we told by the fire as the gaslight bubbled like a diver. Ghosts hooed like owls in the long nights when I dared not look over my shoulder. Animals lurked in the cubbyhole under the stairs where the gas meter ticked. And I remember that we went singing carols once when there wasn't the shaving of a moon to light the flying streets. At the end of a long road, there was a drive that led to a large house, and we stumbled up the darkness of the drive that night, each one of us afraid, each one holding a stone in his hand in case, and all of us too brave to say a word. The wind through the trees made noises as of old and unpleasant and maybe web-footed men wheezing in caves. We reached the black bulk of the house. What shall we give them? Hark the Herald? No, Jack said. Good King Wenceslas. I'll count three. One, two, three. And we began to sing, our voices high and seemingly distant in the snow-felted darkness round the house that was occupied by nobody we knew. We stood close together, near the dark door. Good King Wenceslas looked out on the Feast of Stephen. And then a small, dry voice, like the voice of someone who has not spoken for a long time, joined our singing. A small, dry, eggshell voice from the other side of the door. A small, dry voice through the keyhole. And when we stopped running, we were outside our house. The front room was lovely. Balloons floated under the hot water bottle gulping gas. Everything was good again and shone over the town. Perhaps it was a ghost, Jim said. Perhaps it was trolls, Dan said, who was always reading. Let's go in and see if there's any jelly left, Jack said. And we did that. Always on Christmas night, there was music. An uncle played the fiddle, a cousin sang Cherry Ripe, and another uncle sang Drake's Drum. It was very warm in the little house. Auntie Hannah, who had got onto the parsnip wine, sang a song about bleeding hearts and death, and then another in which she said her heart was like a bird's nest. And then everybody laughed again. And then I went to bed. Looking through my bedroom window, out into the moonlight and the unending smoke-colored snow, I could see the lights in the windows of all the other houses on our hill and hear the music rising from them up the long, steadily falling night. I turned the gas down. I got into bed. I said some words to the close and holy darkness, and then I slept. And now, here are two stories for Billy, John, and Jimmy. The first one is called Bad Mousy. Once upon a time, there was a little girl named Donica who lived with her mother and a little black mouse. Mousy was very bad because no one had taught him to be good. He cut big holes in the bedspread with Donica's little scissors. He threw all of Donica's clean socks into the bathtub when it had water in it. He made little mud tracks all over the rug when he came in. Donica's mother said, "Mousie, don't you know that nobody loves a bad mouth? That's why we don't want you to stay here with us anymore." And she took her broom and swept him out of the house. "Now don't you come back until you learn to be a good mouse," she called after him. Then she closed the door and locked it. But Bad Mousie waited until dark. Then he crawled under the gate and crept through a crack in the wall. And next morning, there he was again. Donica was glad to see him, but Mousie was still bad. He pulled the top off the powder can and spilled powder all over the rug. He tangled Donica's hair and scattered her ribbons on the floor. He tipped over things on the breakfast table and spilled cocoa and orange juice and lots of milk. This made Donica's mother very angry. "Bad Mousie," she said, "I'm going to put you in a box and close it tight and throw it into the washtub full of water." And she did. But the box was only glued together, and the water softened the glue, and the box fell apart. So Mousie swam up to the top and scrambled out. Then he shook the water out of his ears, and he climbed the cellar stairs and squeezed under the door. And there he was again. And Donica was glad to see him. Next day, Mousie was as bad as ever. He pulled all the books out of the shelves and tore out some of the pages. He unrolled yards and yards of paper in the bathroom. He spilled green ink all over the inside of a desk drawer. Now Donica's mother was very, very angry. She said, "Mousie, you are so very bad that I shall feed you to the night owl." So she took him and tied him with three white strings to the fence in the backyard. Then she put a yellow ribbon around his neck so that the owl could see him better in the dark and fly down and gobble him up. But before the stars came out, the mouse wriggled and tugged and finally got his feet loose. Then he untangled his tail and nibbled through the strings round his tummy. So he was free again, and he ran and hid all night. The owl couldn't find him. Next morning he came back to the house and climbed in an open window, and there he was again. And Donica was glad to see him. But Mousie was still bad. The next time Donica's mother was away at the store, he took a purple crayon and scribbled all over the yellow wallpaper. Then he dumped all the buttons out of the button box. He found a bottle of shoe polish and he painted the floor white. When Donica's mother came home and found the awful mess he had made, she grabbed him by his little string tail. Then she pressed her lips together hard, and she thought and thought of a way to get rid of him. At last, she decided to let the wind blow him away. So she got her oldest umbrella and fastened Mousie to the handle with an old belt. Then she carried him up onto the roof and opened the umbrella so that the wind could blow him off, right off into the sky. The little mouse kicked and squeaked, but it did him no good, for soon the umbrella was sailing up, up over the treetops, and Mousie was fastened to it. After a while, the umbrella drifted gently down onto a little pink cloud. Mousie managed to get himself unbuckled, and he let the big umbrella blow away. Then he lay down on the soft, warm cloud to rest. He was really very lonely, and he wished that he could go home to Donica and her mother and live there with them. "Maybe I could learn to be good," he thought. All of a sudden it began to get cold, and the cloud began to drip. Drip, drip, drop, drop, dripple, dropple. The cloud was changing into rain. Mousie was getting wetter and wetter. Soon there was no cloud to lie on, and down he tumbled with the raindrops, down, down, until he splashed into a muddy puddle. Mousie was cold and wet and very unhappy. He had to swim and wade to get out of the big puddle. Then he ran as fast as he could to Donica's house. But before he crept under the door, guess what he did? He wiped his muddy little feet on the doormat. And when Donica looked around, there he was again. "Donica," said the mouse, "could you teach me to be a good mouse? I want to stay here with you where it's warm and cozy and I can be your friend." "I'll try to teach you," said Donica. "And I'll try to be good," said the mouse. So Donica taught him how to begin to be good. She showed him what not to touch. She told him to cut paper dolls instead of bedspreads with her little scissors. She taught him how to wipe up the milk he spilled. She helped him pick up books and put the buttons and crayons away in their boxes. Then she kissed him to help him get good faster. When Donica's mother came home from the store, she certainly was surprised, for there was Mousy helping Donica set the table for lunch. "Mommy, I'm teaching him to be a good mouse," said Donica, "and Mousy is trying very, very hard. Please let him stay." So Donica's mother was proud of them both, and she told Mousy that she, too, would help him learn to be good. Then she hugged Donica and the mouse, and they all joined hands and danced round and round. Next day, Mousy brought in the morning newspaper and the mail. He wiped all the forks and spoons and put away the pans after breakfast. And he spread the wet tea towels out on the grass to bleach in the sun. So Mousy became a good mouse, and they all lived cozily together again. And the second story is about a little goat whose name was Georgie. In a little village in New England, there was a little house which belonged to Mr. and Mrs. Whittaker. Up in the attic of this little house, there lived a little ghost. His name was Georgie. Every night at the same time, he gave the loose board on the stairs a little creak, and the parlor door a little squeak. And then Mr. and Mrs. Whittaker knew it was time to go to bed. And Herman, the cat, he knew it was time to prowl. And as for Miss Oliver, the owl, she knew it was time to wake up and say, "Whoo!" And so it went, with everything as it should be, until Mr. Whittaker took it into his head to hammer a nail into the loose board on the stairs and to oil the hinges of the parlor door. And so the stairs wouldn't creak anymore, and the door wouldn't squeak anymore, and Mr. and Mrs. Whittaker didn't know when it was time to go to bed anymore, and Herman, he didn't know when it was time to begin to prowl anymore. And as for Miss Oliver, she didn't know when to wake up anymore, and went on sleeping. And Georgie sat up in the attic and moped. That was a fine how-do-you-do. Pretty soon, though, Georgie decided to find some other house to haunt. But while he ran to this house and then to that house, each house already had a ghost. The only house in the whole village which didn't have a ghost was Mr. Gloam's place. But that was so awfully gloomy. The big door groaned so, and the big stairway moaned so. And besides, Mr. Gloam's himself was such a crotchety old man, he came near frightening Georgie half to death. So Georgie ran away to a cow barn where there lived a harmless cow. But the cow paid no attention to Georgie. She just chewed her cud all the time, and it wasn't much fun. Meanwhile, a lot of time went by, and it rained a good deal, and during the winter it snowed to beat the band, and out at the cow barn, Georgie was terribly cold and uncomfortable. But what with the dampness from the rain and the coldness from the snow, something happened to that board on the Whittaker stairs and to the hinges on the Whittaker parlor door. It was Herman who discovered it and told Miss Oliver, and she woke up with a start. Miss Oliver flew right over to the cow barn to tell Georgie that the board on the stairs was loose again, and that the hinges on the parlor door were rusty again. What glad tidings that was for Georgie. He went running right home, lickety-split. And so, at the same old time, the stairs creaked again, and the parlor door squeaked again, and Mr. and Mrs. Whittaker knew when it was time to go to sleep again, and Herman, he knew when it was time to begin to prowl. And as for Miss Oliver, she knew when it was time to wake up again and say, "Whoo!" Thank goodness. And so, Merry Christmas from Harry.
Merry Christmas from Dorothy.
Merry Christmas from Angie.
Merry Christmas from Stephen.